But hey, let me just before we jump in and we talk about vulnerable kids, we talk about Jesus, and let me give a state of the county talk. So today in Santa Clara County, about a third of the kids that enter into foster care are still being sent out due to a shortage of foster families. Just this last week, I was talking with a couple of foster moms in Santa Clara County. One said that she got 3 calls in a period of 18 hours for children. 2 of those calls were for infants, one that was ready to be taken in, one that was still at the hospital, and then another call for a sibling set, 8 and 10 years old, if I remember correctly. I talked with another foster mom who said she just finished chatting with her social worker. She said the social worker said that there were 27 kids that are being shuffled around right now in offices here in Santa Clara County. They're desperate to find a place for these children. This breaks my heart. I know this breaks your heart, and of course it breaks the heart of God. And so Foster the City was started with this in mind, that we want to see churches work together to try to change that. So Foster the City is a movement of churches who are raising foster families and support friends for foster families. We're going to keep going until there's more than enough to meet the need. And I will say we're making progress. Did you know that almost 60% of all active foster families in Santa Clara County are now coming from Foster the City churches? More than the majority. Isn't that awesome? The majority of active foster families licensed through the county are from Christian Bible-centered homes. I think that's absolutely incredible and something we're celebrating. But we still have a long ways to go. Guys, we have this collective vision among our churches that one day there's going to be a waiting list of families rather than a waiting list of kids in need of a home. And it's going to be churches like NBC on the front lines helping make that happen. But over this last decade that we've been going, man, it's been one of the great gifts of my life to just to see so many stories. I could tell you, we just spend the whole morning just telling stories together of families that have turned their life upside down. I could tell like stories like the Brown family. The Browns were just about to become empty nesters when they adopted 5 kids under the age of 9. I can tell you stories like Anne, who in her 80s welcomed home a teenage son, welcomed home a teenage boy. Or I can tell you my friend Lindsay. We got an email from a social worker who told us about a little boy who they said this little boy has been living in the hospital for 8 months because we can't find any family that will take in this precious but terminally ill young boy. And so we helped to get the word out, and my friend Lindsay reached out. She said, "Philip, I think I've been praying about it. I think that this little boy is meant to be my son." And so sure enough, she quit her job. She turned her life upside down. Her family welcomed in this little boy. And not only did this little boy end up getting to experience family and home, but ultimately this little one ended up experiencing a higher quality of life than any of the doctors or social workers thought possible. And that little boy was so deeply loved all the way until the end. I mean, we could tell you story after story. It's been one of the great gifts of my life, watching the way families have turn their life upside down for the vulnerable children and watch churches like NBC move towards kids that matter so much to the heart of God. In fact, and this is going to sound like a humble brag, please hear my heart. I don't mean it to be this way, but I do want to give testimony to what God is doing. A few months ago, leaders from Washington, D.C. actually reached out. There are these leaders that get together a couple times a year and they talk about, new research in child welfare and best practice and new innovation. And they've been hearing about what's happening on the West Coast. And they said, "Would you guys come out and would you be willing to share with us about how are you seeing such high caliber families, such self-giving, long-suffering families? How are you seeing so many churches start getting engaged?" So I got the chance to go out and share with these leaders in DC. And I got to share about our model and our mission and our pipeline. I got to talk about the app that we created that connects foster families with their support teams. But at one point in the conversation, I said, "But listen, if I can be frank, and if I could have the opportunity to just put my cards on the table, we're not seeing foster families step forward because of an app. We're not seeing foster families and churches get involved because of a pipeline. We're seeing families show radical, extravagant love to our vulnerable neighbors because at the core of who we are as followers of Jesus is the belief that we have been extravagantly, radically loved, right? We love because he first loved us." I really like the way Mr. Rogers, if I can quote him, said it. He said, "We have been loved into loving." We are loved into loving. In fact, when we first launched Foster the Bay back in 2015 at my church, we spoke from 1 John 3:1. This is what 1 John 3:1 says. This is the verse that we launched from. It says, "Behold the great love the Father has lavished on us that we might be called children of God." And that is what we are. This was our foundation. Look at the great love that he has lavished on us. And this cup overflowing belovedness was not just the spark 10 years ago. I am more convinced than ever that rooting ourselves and abiding in the love of God is the only thing that will enable us to keep going, to become who we were meant to be, and ultimately to faithfully cross the finish line. And you might be thinking, well, that's great. That's great for Foster the City. That's great for you guys. But of course, this goes far beyond foster care, doesn't it? Give you another example I kind of saw up close and personal. Years ago, my wife Jessica and I were living in India. I was a part of a church planting organization. This is before the Foster the City days. And when I was off doing my thing, my wife would serve at this home called Grace Home. It was a home for girls who had been impacted by AIDS. She would do that Monday through Friday. And then on Saturday morning, she would volunteer at this place called Home of Hope. And Home of Hope was a place where they would, it's a ministry where they would drive around the streets of Bangalore and they would find men and women and children who were diseased and dying and alone out on the streets. And they would pick them up and they'd bring them back into their ministry facility and they would do everything that they could to try to nurse these folks back to health. And if that wasn't possible, at the very least, they would provide them with a place where they could die with dignity. And so my wife would go on Saturday mornings and she would volunteer at the Home of Hope. And her job was on Saturday mornings, she would bathe the women. There's a lot of things that I would like to do on a Saturday morning. What in the world would compel someone to want to spend their Saturday morning bathing the leprous and the diseased and the dying? For that matter, what would compel someone to want to live a life of radical generosity? What would compel someone to want to live a life of compassion and service to their neighbor as opposed to a life of self-preservation? What would compel someone to be willing to forgive the person that hurt them the most? What would compel someone to live with a sense of peace and stability in a world like ours right now that is so fractured and broken and divided? To live with peace and hope and faith in a cultural moment like we live in today? The answer, obviously, to all of this and to so much more is this: behold the great love of God. Look at the great love of God that he has lavished on us. We have been loved into loving. Please hear me. If you want to experience the fullness of what God has for you, what he wants to develop in you, and what he wants to do through you, it begins and ends with, look at this great love that the Father has lavished on us. We might see this better than anywhere in the life of Jesus. The gospel writers tell us that of three times when the Father speaks over Jesus in an audible voice. Three times the Father speaks over Jesus in a way that those around could hear. You might remember a couple of them. So the first time Jesus is being baptized in the Jordan, he comes up out of the Jordan. And as he's coming up, do you remember what the Father says? He speaks out and says, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." And from that identity as the beloved, Jesus launches into his public ministry. So then you fast forward a little bit and we find Jesus on the mountain. He's transfigured in glory, right? He's standing with Peter, James, and John. He's transfigured in glory. And the Father speaks over the Son and he says, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Remember? And you fast forward a little bit more, and Jesus is just about at the climax of his ministry. He's just about to go to the cross. He's actually praying to the Father, and he says something to this effect. He says, "Father, would you glorify your name through me?" And then the Father responds and essentially says, "I have glorified my name through you, and I'll continue to glorify." In other words, You already have pleased me. You already have brought me so much pride and delight, and I know you're going to keep going. Three times, the Father speaks over the Son and essentially says the same thing. I love you and I'm really proud of you. I love you and I delight in you. Isn't it interesting that the Father says essentially the same thing, three different times? He could have said three different things. He had three tries. He could have said, this is my righteous son. This is my wise son. This is my compassionate son. He could have said three different things about the son, but he doesn't. He just says, I love you and I'm proud of you. I love you and I delight in you. You know, I was processing this. Please hear me. I was processing this with my spiritual director. And he said, you know, Philip, the older that I get, the more convinced I am that spiritual maturity, spiritual growth as a follower of Jesus is less about how much obscure doctrine I can master. It's less about how hard I strive every single day. It's even less about how well I manage my sin. And it's more about an ever-increasing awareness of God's love for me. By the way, that's the message. I have a lot more to say, but that's really it. Okay. if we walk away with just that, I'm happy and this is a win. Listen, spiritual maturity is more about an ever-increasing awareness of God's love for you. This has been completely transforming the way that I approach each day. So instead of starting my day like I was, where I'd say, God, would you help me to love you more today? Help me to love you better today. I'm starting my day instead with, God, would you help me to know your love more today? When I go to the scriptures in the morning, I'm going to read from Genesis to Revelation, front to back, just looking for the love of God. Would you just help me to see your love, Lord? And so I've been going to the Bible, and gosh, guys, his love has been leaping off the page. Can I give you a couple of examples? Let me give you one right from the very beginning of the Bible. I'll give you one from right at the very end of the Bible. So I open up Genesis and I start reading through the creation account. And I'm like, God, help me to see your love today. And I start to read about how God is, he's creating this world. He's preparing this place for you and for me, for us to live in and to grow and to enjoy him and to walk with him and to know his love, to know a loving relationship with him. And I read about how God walks with Adam and Eve in the garden in the cool of the evening. He prepared this place. And it brought me back actually to my earliest days as a father. My son turned 18 this week. And I know you're thinking, wow, you look 18. All right, no. My son turned 18 this week. And so I got I'm wearing all of our feelings and all the reflections and all of that. But it brought me back to 18 years ago when I first became a father. And I started to think about how I prepared a place for my son. We had a room. We painted it. We put together a crib. We bought this rocking chair that we couldn't afford at the time. But that was going to be the place where my wife fed him and nurtured him and sang over him and just built this bond and built this attachment with him. We bought him stuffed animals and these books that he can enjoy. We bought this rug for the middle of the room where eventually my son Israel and I would just roll around and wrestle for hours. All right, we prepared this place. The bottom line is every square inch of that room was set apart as a place for our son to live and to grow and ultimately to experience our love for him. And it hit me like that's exactly what God is doing in creation. This world that we live in was prepared as a place for you to live and to grow and to taste and experience his love for you. Everything is a gift. What if we went throughout our day with that in mind to understand that the sound of our children's laughter is a gift for you? This isn't in my notes here, but I probably should stay on track. But let me just say this. A couple days ago, I was driving with my kids back from a baseball game, and we were talking a little bit about some of these. We were talking about what God's been showing us lately, and I was sharing with them about just been like more and more noticing all of these just great gifts that God gives to us in his creation that I think is not meant to terminate on the gift. It was meant to point us to the giver of the gift. And I was talking about, it's like the wind, I was telling the kids, it's like my windshield in my car. I can look at the windshield or I can look through the windshield to what's on the other side. You can listen to your kids' laughter or you can listen to what's on the other side of the laughter. You can look at the flowers as you go by, or you can look at what's on the other side of the flowers. There's a giver who gave you that good gift because he loves you and he delights in you. And this is probably a couple months ago, now this is kind of at the turn of spring, I was actually on a jog, and this is like when the flowers were blooming and spring was kind of on its way, and I remember running past this bush, and there were all of these flowers blossoming, and the scent of the flowers like smacked me in the face as I was running, and I just blurted out, "I love you too." Because to me, it was a way that he was telling me, it was just what, "I love you and I delight in you." This is what I wrote down. "Every tree and flower, every mountain and meadow, every creature and star in the sky was created by our good Father as a gift and as a setting where we might be with him and know his love." What if you went through this week knowing that every sunrise is an "I love you" and every sunset is an "I delight in you"? We flip to the end of the Bible. We get a picture at what's to come. A glimpse when all things would be made new, when every tear would be wiped away, that death would be no more, that all the sad things would become untrue. Do you remember the setting in the last couple of pages of the Bible? Do you remember the setting where we're told all of this is going to come to its culmination? It's a wedding. It's a wedding celebration. Where when the groom, who is Jesus, is united to his bride, us, the church. I've officiated quite a few weddings over the years, and hands down, my favorite part of the wedding is when the doors open in the back of the church and the bride starts to make her way towards the groom. Everybody stands, everybody gasps, she's so beautiful. And inevitably, as I'm standing here, I always take a little glimpse right here at the groom, right? You all do that too, right? Because the groom has like a goofy grin on his face. He's smiling ear to ear. Maybe there's a single tear coming down his cheek. He is just so overwhelmed at the love that he has for this woman that is making her way to him. Husbands, do you remember that moment? Can you think back to what was going through your mind and your heart and your body in that moment as this woman that you love so much is making her way towards you and she finally will be yours? Do you remember? Wives, can you remember that moment? Can you remember the look on his face as you were walking towards him? Do you remember that? It's been 22 years that I've been married to my wife, Jessica. I can still remember that moment. There were hundreds of people in the room. Everybody was dressed to the nines. The room looked beautiful, but everything was a blur. I had eyes for one as she was making her way towards me. What does it say about how God feels about you that he says, "You know, the best way that I can help you understand my love for you is to give you the picture of a wedding, the way that a groom feels about his bride on their wedding day. That's how I feel about you." Isn't that incredible? Can I ask you a question? Don't answer out loud, of course, but I do want you to think about this internally. Every person here. When God thinks about you, what comes to his mind? Think about that for a moment. When God thinks about you, what comes to his mind? I've asked that question to different groups and in different settings in the past. Can I tell you what the most common response, because we've actually at times we processed our answers together. Here is the most common response to that question that I've heard. Disappointment. When God thinks of me, he's disappointed. Did anybody relate with that? That was my answer for a very, very long time. I would just think, man, but look at all the mistakes that I've made. Look at all the messes that I've made. Look at all the people that I've hurt. Look at all the things that I've done and continue to do. Look at all the things that I should have done and didn't. Surely God just must be up there scowling, shaking his head, disappointed. But the more that I have been grappling with, wrestling with this stubborn, persistent, steadfast, enduring love of God, the more that I'm realizing, and I hope it's okay that I say this, the more that I'm realizing, even my sin can be a catalyst to knowing the love of God. Even the darkest parts of my life can actually catapult me into an ever-increasing awareness of God's love for me. Can I give you an example? I think of it like this. So my family and I, we had a house fire a few years ago. One of my kids took ash from our fireplace, put it into the garbage can outside, which is a big no-no. He didn't realize there were still hot embers in the ash. So within a matter of time, the trash can outside went up like a torch. By the time my wife saw it, the flames were already making their way into our garage. I was out running errands at the time. She calls me screaming, and she said, "Philip, our house is on fire." She said it with a lot more emphasis than that. Sure enough, I race home. There's four fire trucks outside our house. It took us 10 months until we could move back home. The day after the fire, we are walking through. My family and I went to the house to go kind of look over the destruction and the damage. We walked through the house, and one of my sons came up to me, and he said, "Dad, it was me. Dad, I was the one that put the ash in the garbage can." I couldn't wrap my arms around my son fast enough, because I needed him to know in that moment of confession, I needed him to know that nothing had changed about my love for him. Nothing. And in fact, when I think about my son, and when he thinks about decades to come from now, and when he looks back at his relationship with his father, my guess is maybe he thinks a little bit about, you know, some of the I love yous when I dropped him off at school. Maybe he thinks about the high fives after, you know, a good basketball game. But my guess is that when he thinks about his relationship with me, perhaps it's when we were standing together in the destruction, standing together in the mess, when he got to experience maybe the most potent expression and most potent experience of my love. So maybe it's the same with you. Maybe it's when we sit with God in our mess, in our garbage, and we say, "God, I'm sorry." And he wraps you up in his love. Maybe that's the moment where you get to experience the most potent, vibrant experience of his love. Pete Gregg is the founder of the 24/7 prayer movement. He said this. He said, "The most important discovery that you will ever make is the love the Father has for you. Your power in prayer will flow from the certainty that the one who made you, get this, likes you. He's not scowling at you. He's on your side. And unless our mission and our acts of mercy, our intercession, petition, confession, spiritual warfare begin and end in the knowledge of the Father's love, we will act and pray out of desperation, determination, and duty instead of revelation, expectation, and joy." Now, it might be tempting to say, "Dude, this is really basic. God loves me. Got it. I've been singing that since Jesus loves me. I've been singing that since I've been a kid. I've memorized John 3:16, for God so loved the world. Got it. Let's move on. This is milk. Give me some meat." Here's the deal. We were never meant to graduate from this. We were never meant to move on from this. Jesus actually says that. He says, "As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you." Then what he's to say? "Abide in my love." Abide means to remain there. It doesn't mean you go visit it every once in a while. It's not a checkbox and then you move on. It's that literally means make it your home. That's where you live. You and I were meant to spend the rest of our lives learning just how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. That's what Paul says in Ephesians 3. He says, I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power together with all the Lord's holy people to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses all knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. Don't let that last little line escape. If you want to, I'm guessing this is true for most of us. You want to be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. You want to be complete in Christ. You want everything that God has for you. You want to become the person that he desires you to be. You want to do the things that he wants to do through you. You want to become complete in Christ. How does that happen? Paul just says it. We have to know a love that surpasses knowledge, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is his love for you. What do you think Paul meant by that, by the way? Tim Keller asked that question in a sermon on Ephesians 3, and I've been thinking about it since. What do you think he meant, wide, long, high, deep love of Jesus? He surely had something in mind when he gave those descriptors. We can't get into the mind of Paul. Can we guess, though? Maybe? What do you think he meant by the wide love of Jesus? Maybe what Paul is thinking about is Revelation 7, John describing the throne room of God. When he's talking about a multitude of people from all nations and tribes and languages and colors and class and background, all standing together side by side, worshiping the Lamb on the throne, standing together with these pristine white robes, like every stain cleansed, every conceivable mistake forgiven, standing shoulder to shoulder, worshiping the Lamb who sits on the throne. Maybe that's what he's talking about, the wide love of Jesus. And maybe the more that we understand the wide love of Jesus, the less likely we are to show prejudice towards somebody who looks or acts differently than us. Maybe the less likely we are to condemn somebody or to think that anybody is outside of the reach of Jesus. What about the deep love of Jesus? Maybe Paul was thinking about the descent of Jesus. Maybe he was thinking about what he wrote in Philippians 2, that Jesus, though he was in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be held onto, but was willing to make himself a servant, being made in human likeness. Right? Remember, Jesus' death was not the death of a martyr. Jesus came to drain the cup of wrath that belonged to you and me. The highest of highs descends to the depths of hell so you and I can ascend to the heights of heaven. And maybe the more that we understand the depth, the deep love of Jesus, the more that we too will live with humility and service and compassion. Sister Teresa Noble said it like this. She said, the more that we too will eagerly descend. What about the long love of Jesus, the length? Maybe Paul is thinking about the perseverance of Jesus. That Jesus is the shepherd who leaves the 99 to pursue the one. That though I am so prone to wander, so prone to leave the God that I love, I'm so prone to run, that he is the hound of heaven. He's on our heels. There is no distance he would not travel. No mountain he would not climb. No wall he would not kick down to get back to the ones that he loves. And maybe the more that we understand the long love of Jesus, the perseverance of his love, the more hope and the security that you and I will know. What about the height of his love? This one's almost beyond description. Here's what I can say, though. Jesus doesn't just want you to experience a fraction of his love. This isn't Costco samples, okay? This is not a little taste. And in John 17, Jesus is praying, get this, and he says, Father, the glory that you and I shared before creation, I want them to share it too. Think about that. the glory that the Jesus, the Son and the Father experienced before creation, he wants to invite us into that. Guys, one of my highlights of ministry last year was I got a chance to do some ministry in Oxford. It was an incredible time. One of the days I was in Oxford, it was a complete day off. I had no obligations, nothing to do. It was a Sunday. The weather was perfect. I borrowed a bike from the hotel that I was staying at. I rode all around the town. I went to Tolkien's home where he wrote Lord of the Rings. I went to C.S. Lewis's home where he wrote Narnia and a bunch of other great works. It was Sunday, so I actually went and I attended the church service where Lewis worshiped, and I actually sat in his pew. And then I spent the afternoon like reading this great book in this like gorgeous English meadow. For my personality, the things that I like, it was about a perfect day. Can I tell you what was going through my mind all throughout that day? Man, I really wish Jessica was here. I really wish my wife is here. Not because I was lonely. I wasn't lonely. Not because the day was lacking anything. Again, the day was just about perfect. It's just that when you love someone, you want to share your joy with them. Guys, God is not lonely. He is not lacking anything apart from us. But because he loves us, I mean, wonder of wonders, he wants to share his joys with us. No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has imagined the things that God has prepared for those who love him. The degree to which we know and savor God's love for us is the degree to which we will live with joy and hope and wonder and perseverance and compassion and without fear or shame or worry or pride. Francis Chan wrote a great book around this last year called Beloved. The premise of the book is that, Francis just had this growing awareness in his own life that everything in his Christian life, like this, his pursuit of holiness, his compassion for the vulnerable, everything needs to emanate from his identity as beloved. You might have heard of Francis Chan's name. And for many of us, we first heard about Francis from his book that he wrote called Crazy Love. It kind of took the church world by storm years ago. And that book he wrote really as a kind of a call to the American church to pick up their cross and follow after Jesus, to kind of get out of our pews and to live a more radical life of sacrifice and devotion to God and care for our neighbor and so on. But in his most recent book, Beloved, Francis wrote this. I thought this is interesting. He said, "It may sound like I'm contradicting everything that I wrote in Crazy Love. The point of that book was to address the fact that the Christianity of the New Testament looks extremely different from what we are experiencing in the U.S. We attend church services that make us feel comfortable when Jesus commanded us to deny ourselves, pick up our cross, and follow him. My fear while I wrote the book was that we resembled the lukewarm church of Laodicea in Revelation 3. In love, I was hoping to stir people's convictions because I didn't want them to be spit out of the mouth of God." Listen to this. "I don't regret writing Crazy Love. I just wish I had written this book first." If we don't believe, receive, and meditate on the love of God regularly, the message of Crazy Love can lead people into frantic works. Before settling on Beloved, my original plan was to title this book Crazy Loved. Do you guys hear that? Crazy Loved comes before Crazy Love. We are loved into loving. And it's not just any old love, it's a crazy love. There's a love that God has for us that goes beyond what makes sense, that goes beyond what's rational and reasonable. Lisa Bevere calls it a wild and fierce love. Tyler Staton calls it a stubborn love. G.K. Chesterton called it the furious love of God. Brennan Manning called it the furious longing of God. Fury might sound funny, like it's angry. We think of fury like anger, but it's more like the fury of a storm. Storms don't get angry, but there's an intensity to it. There's a wildness to it. John O'Donohue, the Irish poet, he says, "May you know the urgency with which God longs for you." Perhaps my favorite is the way that Dorothy Day said it. She calls it the reckless way of love. Not reckless like careless. Not reckless like thoughtless. Reckless as in no matter the cost. Come what may. Whatever it takes kind of love. It's a love that forgives not seven times, but 70 times seven. A love that leaves the 99 for the one. It's a love that reveals itself to the infants and to the foolish, not to the wise and the elite. It's a love that saves and sanctifies and stubbornly pursues you. It's a love that becomes vulnerable for the sake of their vulnerable. It's a love that took on flesh. Why? So that it could be pierced by the ones it created. That makes no sense. It's an overwhelming, never-ending, steadfast, enduring, reckless love of God. And the more that we know and savor this love, the more that we too become a people of love. Again, Brené Manning says it. He says, Christianity happens when men and women experience the reckless, raging confidence that comes from knowing Jesus Christ. And when you and I come to know this reckless love of God, what develops in us is a reckless, raging confidence, and we find ourselves doing something reckless like foster care. And we're back. Did you wonder if I was going to get back to foster care? Here we are. We're back. Guys, it's reckless to foster. It's reckless to voluntarily open your home to dysfunction. That's a reckless thing to do. It's reckless to open your heart and your life to a child who has experienced significant trauma, knowing that you will have to be the one to absorb the consequences of someone else's actions. It's reckless to throw away a life of easy retirement, golf, travel, for more years of diapers and tantrums and science projects. It's reckless to intentionally get attached to a child, knowing that in the end, your heart is going to get ripped out of your chest when you have to say goodbye. It's also reckless to drop your nets and follow Jesus. Claudia Mirabarney wrote this. She said, Jesus said that you are to love one another as I have loved you, a love that will possibly lead to the bloody, anguished gift of yourself. So go now, beloved brothers and sisters, aflame with what you know to do. Love. Invite all to God's feast of furious love. Do as the master commands. Go out at once into the streets and the lanes of the city and bring in here the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame. Bring them starving, bring them bleeding and broken. Go in love, go with love, go because of love. How might the Lord be calling you to do that today? Give you two just brief invitations as we close. How might God first be calling you to extend that self-giving, radical, come what may, no matter the cost, kind of love to your vulnerable neighbor? How might he be calling you to do that? Maybe one of those ways is to get involved to foster the city. Would you be open to learning about what it might look like? I talked about those 27 kids at the outset of the message. 27 kids right now that are being shuffled around in office spaces around Santa Clara County. Years ago, one of the kiddos that we picked up as a foster parent ourselves, we picked her up from the basement of an office building where she'd been living. Maybe your home can be one of the safe places where one of these kids land. These kids who have experienced neglect or significant abuse and have been removed from their families and are desperate for somebody, anybody, who will open up their life and help provide a place of healing and hope. Would you be willing to explore whether or not God may be calling you to create a place like that for a child in this community? Maybe that's not the season of life you're in. Would you be willing to learn more about how to support a foster family? For every foster family that we raise up, I know you guys know this, I'm preaching to the choir here. We've been talking about this for 11 years, but for every foster family we raise up, we want to wrap them with at least four support friends. That's a good looking family out there, isn't it? We're all thinking it. Four support friends that provide practical, emotional, and spiritual support to a foster family. I know we've talked about this before, but only about half of foster families nationwide will keep going after the first year. It's really challenging to foster for a lot of the reasons we've already discussed today. But because of this support friend model and because our motivation is the gospel and loving in the way that we've been loved, we're not seeing about a 50% retention rate after year one. Foster the City families see about a 90% retention rate after year one. Because they're taking this journey. We're doing hard things because we don't do hard things alone. Right, we have people that are showing up and they're bringing meals and they're babysitting and they're offering rides and they're praying for them and they're encouraging them. So maybe that's a role that you could explore as a support friend for a foster family. If you are interested in any way, your next step is simply to grab that card that's right around you and fill out that next step card. I promise you, if you fill that card out, we're not going to send you home today with one of those 27 kids. I swear to you, okay? All we're going to do is we're going to take that card. We're going to email you about an upcoming informational meeting. We have these informational meetings primarily on Zoom to webinar. You don't even have to get dressed back up and come to church. You literally take it from the comfort of your living room. It's about an hour long. And we'll kind of deep dive in what it looks like to be a part of this movement. Would you be willing? That's the ask today. Would you be willing to give 1 hour of your life, 1 hour where you could learn more about how you could get involved and be a part of this movement of Foster the City? Okay, that's one invitation. Here's the second. And this is actually what I was really, really, really praying for as I was driving here to NBC this morning. Would you be ready this week to receive the wide, deep, long, high love of Jesus for you? My prayer for every person in this room from this day forward, that you would have an ever-increasing awareness of God's love for you. He loves you. That's not wishful thinking. It's not even ink on a page. God demonstrates his love for us in this. He proves his love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He loves you. He's not scowling at you. He likes you. Would you have eyes and ears ready to receive the wide and long and high and deep love of Jesus for you this week? You pray with me. God, I thank you so much for, I thank you first, God, for your love. I thank you for your steadfast, enduring love for us, that as hard as we might try to run or to hold you at arm's length, you continually pursue us. God, I thank you that you, again, just give us a confidence that this is not just some hope or some wish, but God, that you proved your love for us, that you died for us. God, I pray that every person in this room would, know this love to an ever-increasing amount, God, throughout this week. God, we love you. We give you all the glory. We thank you, God, for the opportunity to extend that same love to others. We know that we have been loved into loving. God, help us to show that same radical, enduring love for our neighbor that you have shown to us. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.